करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ सो टुडे डिस्कशन टॉपिक इज
सीक्रेट्स ऑफ कर्म योग बेस्ड ऑन ईशावास्य उपनिषद नाउ I shall give a background of this Ishavasya Upanishads and how it deals with the crucial subject of Karma Yoga. Ishavasya Upanishad belongs to the Shukla Yajurveda. As you know, there are four fundamental Upanishads which you most of you are familiar with: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, and Atharvaveda. Of this, Yajurveda has got two declensions, two traditions. One is Shukla Yajurveda, sometimes in English it may be called Shukla, means white, just an official name, because it was expounded by a sage with the name Yajnavalkya, which also the great sage, the great saint philosopher who appears in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The other one is called Krishna Yajurveda. When we deal with this topic eventually, we will deal with Yajnavalkya, the great teacher of Shukla Yajurveda. Now, Ishavasya Upanishads, it is the 40th chapter of one Veda Samhita, Shukla Yajurveda Samhita. It has got a special importance. Why it is so very important when we discuss Karma Yoga? Total, the Shukla Yajurveda Samhita has got 40 chapters, of which the first 39 chapters deal with rituals, ceremonies, practices, not necessarily their deep spiritual significance, but mostly intended for material prosperity, long life, wealth, progeny, and so on. So all the 39 chapters deal with these empirical topics that may help us to live a happy, prosperous life, social, family life, without much of a spiritual import. The 40th chapter is this Ishavasya Upanishad. And from that onwards, the Samhita deals with the subject of the higher transcendental topics, in a way, spiritual life in general. So straight away I shall come to the first and second verses of this Upanishad, because they help us to enter the subject of Karma Yoga directly. The first mantra is Ishavasya Midam Sarvam Yat Kinja Jagatyam Jagat Tena Tyaktena Gunchidaha Madhudha Kasya Siddham. This is the first verse of Ishavasya Upanishad. The second verse is Kurvanneva Iha Karmani Jivisheshatam Samaha Evam Turi Nanya Dhyosti Na Karma Lipyate Nare. These are the two verses you can find, first and second verses. The first verse deals with the higher philosophy of Karma Yoga. That is, karma becomes Karma Yoga when it gets a spiritual orientation. If we go on doing work with a very high level of professionalism, efficiency, work orientation, result orientation, with a lot of success. But then, if we are not able to enjoy, in the true sense of the word, enjoy the essence of life, then it is only karma, action. Action by itself can never bring peace of mind or happiness. This is a central principle in life. Even the most efficient person, the most successful person, a workaholic who works 15 hours a day, accumulates billions of dollars, becomes very prominent, may have to take sleeping pills to get 4 hours of sleep, may quarrel with his wife and children, may go for divorce, and may commit suicide, can become a scourge for humanity, can become a problem in society. It does happen. So what does it mean? Action by itself is not complete. Action is necessary. We should remember, Upanishad tells us, it teaches us how to transcend action, not to get rid of action. There's a great problem if we stop working. We cannot stop working. I can give one glance into the spiritual psychology of the statement I made. If you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna, at the very beginning, the master and disciple, the first chapter, when he is he is advising his student disciple, young Mahendranath Gupta, the chronicler. He makes a point, see, you can stop working only if your mind automatically goes to God. In many contexts he says, if at the name of uttering the sacred name of God, or even a way when you contemplate on God, or when you contemplate on the transcendental spiritual reality, if a hair stands on his head, or tears come to the eyes, then you need not go to a temple or a church. Then you can send in letter of resignation. You can go to a lonely place. But before that, if you do, then what happens, you know? The mind suddenly faces a vacuum. So bitterness, irritability, complaining all the time, and a feeling of total discontentment, a lack of inner fulfillment, which expresses itself in the form of irritability, will be the result if we stop working without transcending work. So transcending work is different from getting rid of work. So I can give the example of a coconut tree. That is a very visible example. I am coming from a land which is full of coconut trees. If you look at the coconut tree, you know, the branches, the leaves of coconut is spread out. Now, if you look at the tree, you find scars, certain spots, which show you where the leaves had grown, which eventually, when they get dry, they automatically fall down. So it leaves a mark there. So the number of these scars show the growth of the tree. But suppose you cut down the leaves, it doesn't grow. The leaves should automatically fall down. So if Sri Ramakrishna says, karma should leave us, we should not leave karma. Action should leave us, we should not leave action. Sri Ramakrishna himself, in his life, you know, in the beginning, he was very meticulous about performance of rituals and worship, puja, all these rituals. Very, very orthodox, very conservative. But then, later on, you know, he could not do any kind of external ritual. At the very beginning, he was very particular about the quality of the bilwa leaf, the tulasi leaves, all flowers that used to plucked from the garden of the Ekshineshwar. He was very meticulous, very extremely meticulous. But later on, he found it very difficult to pluck a bilua leaf from a bilua tree, because in that bilua leaf, he saw the manifestation of the divine. So how to pluck it out? So action left him, he did not leave action. So the point is, we should transcend action, we should not get rid of action. Now, when do we achieve this goal? The Upanishad says, Isha Vasya means Idan Jagat. Idan Jagat, this entire universe. Isha Vasya means it should be enveloped. You should see this whole world as pervaded by the divine reality. At that time, you can leave action. So, everything in this world is divine. It is not a concept. It is a state of experience that we have to reach. There is a great difference between an idea or a concept and its experience level. An idea or concept, we may believe in. And if it's a strong conviction, it can certainly help us in our life. Strong conviction, sincere conviction in the reality of the divine, which is omnipresent, which is all-pervading, can give us, can take us a long way towards experience. But it is only part of the spiritual thing. So, yat kinja jagatyam jagat. Jagat actually means that which is moving. Gachati means moves. Godhata means that which moves. So the point is, whatever you find around should be seen as pervaded by the divine. That's why, you know, it is the root. From that it is third vibhakti, Isha, means by God. By God means by the divine reality. Idam sarvat vasya. It is even sarvat jagat vasya. The entire world should be seen or experienced as being pervaded by the divine reality. Then what happens, you know, then also actually we do not get rid of action. Our action undergoes a change. Our action will be united to another higher idea, that is renunciation. So, action and renunciation. So that means, renunciation means tyaga. See, that's the third word, tena tyaktena. Tyaktena means tyagena, here, in this particular context. Therefore, how should you enjoy this world? Not by enjoying, but by renouncing. By renouncing, we are not losing anything. We are gaining, actually. It's a contradiction in terms. It doesn't agree with the dictionary meaning of the word renunciation. When you renounce something, it's no more ours. But in spiritual life, when you renounce it, you gain. It gets multiplied, comes back to you in several times as much as it is. So, the point is, this action should be linked to tyaga or renunciation. So, how should you enjoy this world? We should not enjoy this world through the word enjoyment. Rather, enjoyment in spiritual life means renouncing. Renouncing what? Renouncing desire. Renouncing our obsessive attachment or desire to what we get as a result of our action. So you can find that I shall first try to follow the verse itself, then I shall give the broad-based meaning in a spiritual context. So first, you know, tena tyaktena gunjita means here, tyakta, you know, the point is that tena tyaktena gunjita. So the word bhuj dhadu is something to do Sanskrit meaning. Bhuj actually means to eat food, to enjoy. But Shankaracharya gives a higher meaning. He says, palayetha, one word is used by Shankaracharya. It means, by enjoying through renunciation, you protect the world. By enjoying, through enjoyment, you do harm to the world and do harm to our own life. But by enjoying through renunciation, what happens? We protect this world. How do we do that? Through self-control, through self-restraint. This is the somewhat literal meaning of this verse. Now I shall just try to drive home the idea how it applies in our life. How action when linked to renunciation makes for fulfillment. Suppose we have a small stream, a narrow stream. A little water is flowing through the stream. And you know, that water may get dried up in the summer. Or it may not be only that, you know, in narrow streams or rivulets, you can get water only for a very short period of the year. But suppose you link that rivulet, that narrow stream, to this lake Tahoe. You cut a canal and link this narrow stream to this lake. What happens? Then the water will never be dry. The water will continuously flow. That's an example. So when you think of the narrow stream with only little water, which may not remain there throughout the year, which may get dried up, and it may get dirty and filthy sometimes, bacteria and mosquitoes may grow. Because it's not sustained by a constant supply of water. But suppose you link that river, that narrow stream, to an ocean or to the lake, then what happens? The water becomes perennial. The river becomes eternal. Its water never gets dried up. So Tyaga is like the Lake Tahoe or ocean. So when Tyaga or renunciation idea is included, is linked to action, then action becomes a great joy. This is the technique of converting or translating action into action plus contemplation. Action plus contemplation, action plus renunciation means karma yoga. Action by itself means workaholism, professionalism, anxiety neurosis, depression, complaining, a kind of lack of peace of mind within, irritability, and working hard for 15 hours of the day till one's 80th or 90th year, and then when you look back, bank balance may be quite hefty, good, but the inner psychological, mental bank balance will be empty. It may be minus deposit. So, To enrich our inner life, action should be linked to renunciation. Renunciation means yoga or tyaga. Tyaga and yoga are practically the same. Action becomes, or rather karma becomes karma yoga, when karma is, or action is, linked to tyaga or renunciation. Then it becomes karma yoga. So, it has got two aspects. First, a great spiritual ideal. The great spiritual ideal corresponds to the ocean or the lake Tahoe. And our own life, our normal activity corresponds to a small little river or a stream where only little water flows. So when this river or this stream is linked to the ocean, then the river becomes a perennial river. It will never get dried. So this is the central principle. So we can enjoy life, we can enjoy action. We need not complain. When the action is linked to renunciation, when karma is linked to yoga. This is the essence of the first verse. So I shall just give a broad view of the first two verses, which constitute the essence of Karma Yoga as expounded in the Isavasya Upanishad. The second verse, as I mentioned, you know, Kurvanneha Iha Karmani Jijivisheshatam Sama. So, Kurvanneva Iha. I mean, Kurvanneva actually means don't be inactive, don't be lazy, do work. Work. Be active. Iha actually means, Iha in Sanskrit means Asmin Loki, means in this world. But actually it means every moment of our life. Be active. So as I mentioned earlier, action by itself is a big problem. As I mentioned, you know, every action is imperfect. Why do we call action by itself imperfect? Before we work, we become anxious. We plan a lot, we think a lot, we worry about the scheme, the schedule, the plan. And then when we are actually working, what happens? A lot of anxiety. That's why you find many spiritual seekers, even after working for a long time, somehow they have a strong conviction, but that conviction doesn't translate itself into inner voice or happiness or joy. It doesn't happen because action by itself is incomplete. There are many reasons why it is incomplete. One reason is you won't find any action which is guaranteed to produce the expected result 100%. Very often it happens. And even if in a perfectionist society or in an individual who considers perfectionism as his ideal, his action by itself is perfect. But at the end of the action, if his mind is not happy, he is not joyful, then what's the meaning of working for 13 hours, 14 hours per day? The wealth of human life, inner contentment. The wealth of inner life is not the quantity of action. The quality of action is related to inner contentment. That's why one Sanskrit sloka verse says, the highest wealth is inner contentment, inner joy. Those who do not have this inner joy, he may be a billionaire, but still he is a wretched, he is living in wretchedness and poverty. The worst kind of poverty is mental poverty, which again is kind of spiritual poverty. Plenty of money in the bank, but life is totally in a state of instability or discontentment. Such a person, according to Vedanta, is living in perpetual poverty and wretchedness. On the other hand, if you have got moderate means, you have a higher ideal in life, you have a lot of things to do, a lot of challenging tasks. Life may not be easy. But even in the midst of all this, you look upon all these actions from a higher perspective. We should first of all understand the action by itself is imperfect because it cannot guarantee 100% expected results. Now again, suppose you do everything, still you work hard for long years to help a person, to serve a person, if that person becomes ungrateful or unresponsive, at the end of life, you know what happens, you know? Practically, the action is a success or a failure. That's because if our mind is unaffected by the response of the person for whom we worked, whom we helped, if our mind is always in a state of perfect equanimity, totally unaffected by the response of the other person, then our action is fine. But it doesn't happen. Often we feel disappointed, depressed, when the expected response is not coming. So how to make action perfect? Action can be made perfect. Action can be made perfect by combining action with renunciation. That is the topic of the second verse. Work in this world. See, Vedanta does not tell anyone to be inactive. Rather, Vedanta is in a way, it is very dynamic ideal of action. But not action alone, but action and contemplation. Here, contemplation means renunciation. So that's why the second verse says, live for 100 years. Shatam samaha jijivishe. You can have a desire to live for 100 years. Being fully active. Where in this world, here we are, you know, the Upanishad is not asking us to leave the world behind and go to a forest. But how should we work for 100 years? You have to remember, action by itself is not perfect. Action becomes perfect only when it's combined with renunciation. The idea of renunciation comes when our mind transcends the empirical plane, when our mind realizes the fact the whole universe is pervaded by the divine spirit. When that happens, our whole perspective, our approach to the reality of problems in life changes. Problems do not disappear. But our approach, our perspective, the way we look at the problems undergoes a transformation. And when that perspective changes, then problems become lesser problems. When we reach this stage, then what happens, you know? Contemplation and action, both are transcended. Such a person can remain in a state of perfect peace, equanimity and inner fulfillment without any irritability or any complaint, any discontentment, even when the person is fully involved in action. Even in the midst of action, they can enjoy satisfaction, content. So, Ashtavakra Samhita, Gita is called, is a verse. Nivritti rabi mudasya pravritti ubajayate. Pravritti rabi dhirasya nivritti phalabhagi. It's a very interesting verse. Nivritti means withdrawal from action. Suppose you take retirement or leave for 2 months and go to a retreat center, stay there in perfect contemplation, meditation, without any botheration of the office work. This you can, something like nivritti in a relative sense. Pravritti means being in the midst of all activities, responsibilities, all day-to-day activities, obligations, working hard, perfect, high level of professionalism. This is pravritti. No, this verse says, for an intelligent person, for a wise person, even action itself is a kind of contemplation. Why? Because even in the midst of action, in the midst of activity, that person can enjoy an inner peace within. So, even in the midst of pravritti or action or activity, he can enjoy the result of nivritti or contemplation. Again, it says the opposite, gives the opposite picture also. For a person who is perpetually disturbed the true sense of the term, people can work very hard, take a lot of load of responsibilities and be always active, but mind is not affected. That is the sign of an intelligent yogi. The other person who won't do anything, no work, no call, no contribution, nothing. Sitting quiet. Still always in a state of irritability, complaint. Without doing anything. So the verse says, for a modha means for a fool. I mean a deluded person. For a person who is not aspiring for any higher life, even contemplation becomes a very big botheration or obligation. That's the meaning of. So, how do we transcend the problems of action? That's why evam tu in anyathe dosti. Evam means, if we work like that, how? This is tena tektena gunchita. Even in the midst of all activities, we must remember this world, these obligations, these duties, these problems and conflicts, all these belong to this empirical plane. And empirical world, empirical life is relative. It is always subject to changes. It's by its very nature imperfect and incomplete. You can never expect perfection in this imperfect world. Once we realize this, then problems will not be problems any longer. Problems may be there, but they will cease to be problems so far as we are concerned, because our perspective has undergone a radical change. This is the example given here. So there are many, many interesting examples, interesting stories from our Upanishadic tradition. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there are two wonderful characters. One is a king, a philosopher, the other is a sage, Yajnavalkya himself. The king Janaka was always active, very efficient, was well known for his kingly qualities. But then, even in the midst of all these, he used to discuss philosophy in his court. Now, let us say in our daily life, if we can discuss, at least intellectually. Intellectual discussion is not enough, of course. But something is better than nothing. Even in the midst of all these problems in domestic life, domestic setting, if we can read higher books. Again, not something related to business management, how to improve profit, how to improve marketing technology. No, that again takes us back to this empirical plane. If we can do something, we can discuss something which we are sure is not to bring one extra dollar, which has nothing to do with improving the comforts of material life. If we can take us beyond the basic fundamental principles of utilitarianism, if we can go beyond utilitarian thinking, then they can have peace of mind. So there is always a thread, a chain that connects in our mind between what we do and the results that we expect from our action. In fact, it's not the results that are bothering us. It's not action that is bothering us. What bothers us is our concern about the result. And that is only a mental phenomenon. There's something very interesting. Action doesn't bother us. The results are yet to come. So, what happens, we are worrying about an action that we have already done, and also we are worrying about a result that is yet to come. So, this worry, this concern for the result, that's a chain that links what we do with what we expect. So, this chain should be cut or removed. That is what is done by the principle of Tyaga. So, this chain is rooted in our desire, attachment. We can see many examples. People who try to live spiritual life for many decades, for many years. But then suddenly, a state of irritability, discontentment comes. Spiritual life, it is not a straight line progression. See, when we first start spiritual life, when we try to practice this renunciation, the first maybe a few years, we may feel a great joy, a great uplifting experience will be there. Because from 0 to 2 is a great progress. But from 2 to 5 or 6, we may not feel it's a big progress. So when we are actually progressing from 3 to 10, we may not feel it. But when we progress from 0 to 3, this is big from non-existent to something substantial. 3 is quite good compared to nothingness. So what happens, when we reach one level of spiritual progress, we reach a state where we are not able to feel the progress that we are making. And when we are not able to feel or experience this progress, we may think, oh, we are not progressing. This feeling creates irritability. So Narada Bhakti Sutras, Shandilya Bhakti Sutras, and in a much more graphic language, you find the writings of many of the mystics. Mostly you find in the centuries of Avila, St. John of Cross, and also among the Russian Christian fathers, you find this. Irritability comes, inner voidness comes, the feeling comes, we are not making any progress. Sometimes a kind of irritable feeling, intolerable feeling towards others. So actually, from Vedantic perspective, this is nothing but a natural play of the mind. Once we understand the spiritual psychology of conflicts, then this problem really vanishes. Because as I said, from stage 0 to 3 is a big progress. From 3 to 8, we are actually progressing, but we may interpret that stage as a stage of dead end. A kind of irritability, some darkness of the soul. So at that time, when we face such a crisis, there is one way out of this problem. From a devotional, mystical school of thought, we can say, we must pray. From a Vedantic point of view, we must read the scriptures and think of the natural imperfection, the naturally imperfect condition of this world. The world by its very nature is incomplete, imperfect. So whatever happens in this world should not shock us. Something will shock us only when we expect perfection in something which is very, very nature imperfect. If some problems arise in this imperfect world, then those problems should not shock us. So this vichara, it's called contemplation, it's called vichara in Sanskrit. Of course, in the mystical tradition, they give all this an anthropomorphic interpretation, is a play of the devil, play of the Satan, things like that. So you find in those books, prayer is the recommended method to overcome this problem. But in Vedanta, vichara means thinking on the naturally changeable nature of this world. In Sanskrit, it's called Nitya Anitya Vastu Viveka. Viveka means a discerning mind through contemplation. Nitya means the perfect, the real, the eternal. Anitya means the non-eternal, the non-perfect, the relative. Anitya need not mean unreal, but something is unreal, something is not eternally, absolutely real. So once we keep thinking on this fact, then the world will not shock us. How to get rid of the shock? So the Upanishad says, remember, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. Everything in this world is pervaded by the divine reality. That means the line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual is only an imaginary one. Once we always consider life in two compartments as operating in two different stages. One is secular life, the other is spiritual life. We cannot have peace of mind. Of course, at the very beginning, it is necessary. work and worship, secular life and spiritual life. We meditate maybe 2 hours a day in the morning and evening. We may do puja, reading scriptures, which we consider as spiritual practices. Then we go to office, may get involved, engage in different activities. We consider non-spiritual, secular things. So two watertight compartments. Work for 13 hours, worship for 2-3 hours. That's all. This is natural. This is natural, the first stage in spiritual life. At the second level, what happens? We will be able to consider action itself as a kind of worship. Work as worship. So from work and worship, we graduate to the next stage of work as worship. This is the first stage. So how do we progress from work and worship stage to work as worship stage? So the Upanishad says, Tena Yaktena Gunjita. Enjoy this world. Suffering is not recommended anywhere. Happiness is the goal of Vedanta. The Vedanta also is talking about happiness. But what kind of happiness? At the empirical plane, we have one kind of happiness. When we get something, we become happy. But then that happiness becomes unhappiness when we lose it. So, at the empirical plane, happiness is like a coin with two sides. One side, happiness. The other side, sorrow. Anything that we get in this world, even if it produces satisfaction or happiness for some time, is only a prelude to unhappiness after some time, when we lose it. Now, how do we go for happiness? It doesn't change. It remains static, unchangeable. If we want happiness that remains happiness all the time, there's only one way. We must stop looking for happiness. So, Ashahi Paramam Dukkham Niraja Paramam Sukham means, when we look for happiness, what we are looking for is happiness in a purely empirical sense. Job, money, wealth, whatever. That is fine. And when we lose what we get now, that happiness becomes unhappiness. One side of the coin changes for the other. Now, how to have happiness? We remain happiness for all time. We have to transcend happiness of the empirical plane. And how to transcend happiness at the empirical plane? You should stop looking for happiness. When we stop looking for happiness, then we are also avoiding the risk of unhappiness, because without the idea of happiness, there cannot be unhappiness. So when we transcend the happiness idea, we naturally transcend unhappiness. And when we transcend both happiness and unhappiness at the empirical plane, we reach real happiness in spiritual sense, in the term. So Gita says, Sukham atyandhikam yettat buddhigrahyam atindriyam. So the word used is atyantikam sukham, means the absolute happiness, not empirical. That happiness becomes real when we combine our pursuit for happiness with renunciation. That's why you know the third line of this verse, tena tektena munchita. Literal meaning, if you look at it, you'll be surprised. See, Buddha, as I mentioned, to eat food, enjoy, that's what it means. But that Buddha has got another meaning given by Shankaracharya, who wrote commentary, who made all these ideas available to us. Shankaracharya has not written a commentary, Nobody will be reading this verse. Because they literally don't mean much actually, literally speaking. The deeper spiritual significance, philosophical significance. So he is palayetha, he says. Gunjitha palayetha. It means protect, sustain, preserve. Normally when we enjoy the empirical plane, we don't preserve anything. You eat a cake, it's not preserved anymore. You spend all the money in the bank, it's no more preserved, it doesn't sustain. It disappears. But when we enjoy life through the means of renunciation, which means giving up a desire for the result, that action becomes something totally different. At the psychological plane, you can be active. I can give an example. I won't mention name. Just now it happened, a few days back, that will send a message. You know, we are bringing out a memorial volume, commemorative volume for Vedant, old temple, as part of the consecration program. I had gone to India and, you know, I wanted some articles. So one of the Swamis, who is one of the most learned Swamis right now, Naraja, almost 85 years old, I mentioned name, except in private conversation. So he had promised to write an article. Normally he doesn't write any first article. He was the editor of the developer of me. One of the most learned Swamis right now, 86-year-old, 85. So he had partly completed the article, and then he had an accident. He fell in the bathroom. His head was injured, a lot of bleeding, concussion, that he was hospitalized. You know, but then I came to know of this only after I left Bedumat, when I was traveling. Then I said, Maharaj, Swamiji, please don't take too much of strain. I know that. But you know, today morning the article came. And I heard he got information. His hands were a bit affected. But still, he continued writing, finished the article within a few days. Now, the point sometimes I ask, now often, how. Here we are not talking about Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Jesus Christ or Buddha. We are talking about people who still practice or try to practice the highest karma yoga. So once we take action beyond the empirical plane, then the problems of action will not affect our mind. It may affect our body. So mind is transcended to a higher level. So whatever we take up, we are able to make an effort in that direction. Whether that action produces the expected result or not is a different matter. But anxiety element, the depression element, the botheration element, all these things vanish. You just stay here, do your work, do your best to do the work, and leave everything else to God. And then what happens, you know, one need not worry about anything. So how to do that? We have to transcend the empirical, mentally at least. So, what really happens is, action itself ceases to be a problem. When action becomes a yajna, as in Sanskrit it's called yajna. Yajdhadu. Actually, you know, yajna is a very interesting term. If you read this Monia Williams or Apti, yajna is a kind of ritual. They offer in ancient times, in Vedic age, they used to offer they put different offerings in fire. So it's called Sapta Havir Yajna, means seven types of Vedic rituals, which are highly symbolic. But yajna has got another meaning. Yajna also means any action which is noble, which is sublime, is a yajna. So your eating food can be called a yajna. You know, brahmarpanam, brahmagavi, brahmatma, brahmanakutam. It is called brahma yajna mantra. A mantra, a verse, which describes everything as a kind of offering to God. Where offering is yajna, is Brahman, the absolute reality, fire, in which you put offering is also Brahman. The act of offering is Brahman, what is offered is Brahman, though everything is Brahman. So, when action itself becomes sublime action, by joining it with tyaga, when karma itself becomes karma yoga, by joining it with yoga, then it becomes yajna. That's why yajna vai sreshtatamam karma is one of the most famous definitions, very brief definition, Katyayana var sutra vyakhya. It's an ancient commentary on the Vedic mantras. So it means any kind of action which is sublime with the transcendental idea behind ceases to be an action, it becomes yajna. Yajna means karma yoga. Karma is action, karma yoga is yajna. This yajna has got many advantages. First of all, it doesn't affect us mentally. If somebody tells you, I went to the temple and prayed, I'm tired now, then what happened? He should not be allowed to enter the temple. Because prayer should not make you tired. Prayer should give you a soothing effect to your mind. Prayer should make you feel restful. So, like that, yajna should not make us tired. When we do something, as an action, it makes us tired, irritable, anxious. When the same action is done as yajna, it gives a soothing feeling. It takes us forward in spiritual life. At the same time, it produces its result. So the best of the results are produced. At the same time, it doesn't sit heavily on our shoulders or mind. That is the secret. I'm here talking about even people who are still alive, who undertake a work or a duty which nobody is going to punish them for not doing it, or they are not going to get anything for doing that. That's interesting. Nothing is going to happen if they don't do, and they are not going to gain anything if they do, or if they do actually. But still it is there. And then the best of our ability. Why? Because if that link that connects our action with its result is wrong. Like that, if we can do things for the good of others and also for our good also, without thinking much, without bothering much about the expected result, it becomes karma yoga. Its most sublime word used in the Vedantic literature is called yajna. That's the greatness of it. So, yajnyatha karmanaha anyatra lokoyam karma bandhana. Tadartham karma gondeya mukta sangha samaja. You find the Gita. Whatever you do as yajna. If you do yajna here means, as you remember, as an offering to God. If somebody calculates and worries about what he puts in that, the hundi or the offering box in a church or a temple, it doesn't even for making you unhappy. When he worries about what the donation that he has given, or the money that he has put in that offering box, it won't be an offering. Offering is something that we do with great attention, the greatest of spiritual sensitivity, devotion, at the same time without expecting anything. Then that action becomes yajna, the karma becomes karma yoga. Isha Vasya Upanishad gives a simple method. Remember, The whole world is pervaded by the divine. Therefore, nothing is yours, kasichidhanam. This world is not yours to enjoy, to exploit. If we think this world is ours, for us to enjoy and exploit, there will be no peace. That will be only enjoyment in its most utilitarian implications. The same enjoyment gets a transcendental spiritual meaning when it is transferred to another plane by joining that action with renunciation of mentally renouncing our obsession with the result. So this is just a beginning of a discussion program. So we'll have interaction for about half an hour, and after that we'll continue the discussion. You can give suggestions. It is only you can say kind of test case, you know. So you can give your suggestions if you want me to change the format, the method of exposition. You are most welcome to put forward your suggestions. I stand ready to be corrected.
So Swami, what I had to think of when you were talking is the Gita saying about inaction.
That's true. You know, that's also actually a verse from the fourth chapter. The verse is karmani akarmaya paschit akarmani cha karmayeha sa buddhiman manishesu sa yukta krishna karma. Itself is a very important topic which I plan to discuss in the subsequent sessions, but I shall take it up now. It means the intelligent person, the spiritually elevated person, a yogi, a karma yogi, he can see, he can feel and experience action even when he is doing nothing. And he can feel and experience inaction even when he is in the midst of all activities. This is eternity. Now, again, it also means sabuddhiman manishesu sa yukta krishna karma. He is the one, he is a yogi, he is an intelligent person, and he is able to do everything he does. This is literal meaning. Now, I should come to the answer. Now, so the first part or the one aspect of this verse is obvious from what I have already discussed. When we do not do things with a strong desire for the result, with a strong obsessive feeling that I am doing this, so I deserve the result, I want the result. When we do anything with a strong feeling, the strong attachment, desire for the result, and also strong identification, I am the one who is doing this, then what happens, you know, we won't be able to see inaction. We will see only action. Mm-hmm. But same person, when he does the same action as a yajna, as a karma yoga, he can see, well, my mind and senses are engaged in different activities. But I am the Atman. I am the transcendental supreme reality, which goes far beyond the psychophysical mechanism. Different parts of my body and mind are involved in different activities. But I have a spiritual dimension that goes far beyond my physical, psychophysical mechanism. I'm this Atman. So Atman doesn't do things. It is the indriyan means the different organs, different senses of action and senses of perception. And mind are involved in different activities. The real I is the Atman that goes beyond the psychophysical mechanism. It is not involved in any action. Then you will be able to see and experience inaction. Now, how do we experience action in inaction? That needs some explanation. The idea, you see, the point is akarma meaning. Akarma means, literally means inaction. But in Sanskrit also means withdrawal from action. See, after all, inaction means absence of action. If you are the Atman, and if the Atman, the supreme or the pervading reality, cannot be associated with any kind of action, then how can that act, that Atman, be associated with the absence of action? There is neither action nor inaction. The real I, the real Atman, transcends both action and also the absence of action. So, it transcends both. So, such a person, even when he is physically inactive, he won't feel that he is in a state of inaction, because he was never in a state of action. So, action-inaction equation itself is transcendent. It becomes irrelevant. That's why, if a spiritual seeker, an advanced soul who has reached that state, if he's sitting and he says, oh, now you are doing nothing, if you're asking, that means I was doing something else at other times. Well, now you are doing nothing, you are relaxing. It also implies maybe earlier you are quite busy. No. He was never busy, he was never active, so he can never be in a state of inaction. That's the meaning. The verse is designed to drive home the idea that the real I transcends both action and also absence of action. I tell you, you know, if one reason why these great spiritual seekers are able to do so much and still remain in a state of total mental poise and inner fulfillment is because they practice this. Mm-hmm. And now the same energy and efficiency may be found in some very fanatical people. You know, fanaticism generates energy and heat. Mm-hmm. Fanaticism helps you to achieve great things. I won't refer, but many of the invasions, many of the expansion of empires took place when suddenly a religion that makes you fanatical, obsessed with certain things. A lot of people get organized and they become energized, hyper-energized. The fanaticism can make you energetic, go to dynamics. But that equanimity of mind, the poise, the inner fulfillment will be absent. That's why there is a statement in one of the scriptures, a great yogi, if he wants, he can work a lot, work very hard. Others also can do the same kind of work. But the point is, that person, when he, through fanaticism, you know, he may do a lot, but what happens, you know, that doesn't produce the inner fulfillment, inner peace happens. It produces a lot of problems with the world. But on the other hand, a yogi may be able to do so much, still remains unaffected. Even in terms of mental health, physical health, body may take its own. You know, body, from the five elements, this body, the cancer, hypertension, all these things, you cannot get it off. If you are a yogi, and if you feel I have a headache, a yogi should not have headache. I think one of Swami Vivekananda's disciples, I don't remember. He was so depressed because Swami Vivekananda had diabetes or some health problem. He's a spiritual man, why should he have a health problem? In that case, an elephant is very happy. Tortoise is very, very healthy. Elephant could be very healthy. In fact, those who practice Hatha Yoga, they say, and there are some evidence to show that it's true. In India, in some Himalayan region, there are still people who live for 200 years, maybe 300 years, they say, very healthy, remain unknown. They practice pranayama, hatha yoga. They don't take any medicine. But that doesn't make them spiritual giants. So the point is, the laws of nature, the five elements, the laws of physical mechanism may follow their course. The point is, they are not affected by it. That's the main only difference. whether we are affected or not. That's what makes the difference. A billionaire may lose all the money, he remains unaffected. Janaka, there is an example of Janaka. He was a big emperor. So somebody rushed to the court and reported him, your Mithila, there is a capital, is on fire. The city is burning now. You have to rush. Then he said, oh, why do you worry so much about it? You are going to lose everything. Losing what? He kept quiet and then he made the arrangement for maybe for fire engines to rush to the place. He may have done it. But he was not affected by that. A beggar may be affected if he loses the $1 that he has got in his pouch. And he may make Helen cry about it. An emperor may not bother if his city is on fire. So the main difference is whether the person is mentally affected or not. So that's what makes the difference. Whether it is mine, I do this, it belongs to me. If this thinking is there, then we are affected by it. On the other hand, if this thinking is not there, as in the case of a yogi, then we won't be affected by it. We may work, but we won't be affected. So, a real yogi can experience total inaction even in the midst of activities and may not feel that he is totally inactive even when he is contemplating or sitting or any physical activity. Because he transcends both action and inaction at the empirical plane. That's a meaning. There is there are no questions, so I shall explore, I hope, this idea further. Gita puts it in a different way in one context. Nimitta matram bhava sattis. Nimitta means in a being an instrument, a cause. See, for example, a pen is an instrument in your hands. A book that you are reading is an instrument in your hands. Okay. Now, how can we look upon ourselves as instruments in the hands of God? If you are devotees, the bhakti tradition is very easy. And God's instrument. In the jnana tradition, well, I am not this physical body. I have another spiritual dimension, transcendental dimension. I am the Atma. So both are equally helpful. In the bhakti tradition, what happens? When a devotee literally believes that he is an instrument in the hands of God, two developments take place. One, God begins to operate. God begins to function through him. That's the secret of great mystics, great spiritual seekers, the accomplished great things. So the strong conviction that I am not an ordinary human being, I'm an instrument in the hands of God. It transforms the whole dynamics of our personality. It takes us beyond the psychophysical plane. All the time we remember, I am an instrument in the hands of God. An instrument should not declaration of independence. If you are writing with a pencil or pen, the pen or pencil goes for declaration of independence. You won't be able to write what you want to write. The pencil will write what you want to write. Then you won't be able to write what you want to write. The pencil should completely follow your instruction. It has no freedom, no independence. Because it is an instrument in your hands. So sincerely, if we can believe we are an instrument in the hands of God, it takes care of many problems. For a sincere devotee, it will take care of all problems. It happened in the case of a man like Girishandra Ghosh, who was a profligate drunkard, a bohemian. He was not a spiritual seeker in the conventional sense of the term. He was not a devotee. He was not a gentleman acceptable in civilized circles. In fact, such a person. But he was a genius. He was a great dramatist. He was a playwright. But he led a very loose life. But he had one good quality. Whatever he believed, he did believe. So he said, well, Sri Ramakrishna said, you take your whole responsibility, you hand over to me. And he didn't understand it. But what when he said, well, all right. That all right, he said in the true sense of the term. And from that moment onwards, every time when he did or he tried to do something, the fact that he had handed over his whole responsibility to Sri Ramakrishna, that he is now a means, an instrument in Sri Ramakrishna's hands, he could not do anything wrong. He became saved practically in a very short time. Very often it doesn't happen in our life. The point is when we say, I believe, that statement, believe, is only I want to believe. See, now it is 11:15. We don't believe it's 11:15. We don't have to believe because it's 11:15. We do not have to believe that this is Lake Tahoe. We are not living in the United States. We do not believe because we don't need to believe. So whatever is real, we don't have to make a statement of it. And we cannot deny it. Shankaracharya's commentary has a big statement. Aprasattasya ko nisheda aprasattasya ka prastaha. Prasattasya ko nisheda prasattasya ka prastaha. Statement is very wonderful. Whatever is obvious, whatever is clear, whatever we know to be true, we don't believe in it. We don't make a statement of it. And we do not deny it. Because we force. Similarly, if we can really believe in God, then overnight we can become saints. At first, Swami Vedanta made a statement like that. In fact, all comes from Shankara's commentary. He said, if you really believe you are not this body, if you really be an Atman, on the moment you can become Atman. Just as we believe now 11:15, with the same intensity of faith, we can say, I am Atman. You can't do that. Because there is a qualitative difference between that kind of statement and the statement is 11:15. This is very obvious. So the point is, now how to graduate from an attempt to believe to real belief? So Shankaracharya makes a statement in Vivekachudamani. First of all, we must have a real conviction as to what is real, what is unreal. Then we must get rid of all our desire for enjoyment, nitya, anitya, vastu, veka, ikadi, phalabhoga, viraha. We should not have any desire for any kind of material enjoyment. Then self-restraint and a strong desire for liberation. Let us say, in ordinary sense, a strong desire for spiritual enlightenment. If that strong desire is there, even as a strong, real desire, that will take care of many problems. Because if you have a real, sincere desire for the spiritual, the small problems in material life will not bother us. Oh, it's a nothing. Just like a child may worry and fight over for a chocolate. But grown-up people don't do that. Because then the chocolates are nothing. Mm-hmm. Children may fight for pebbles. Mm-hmm. But grown-up people won't do that. So also, those who have reached a very high level of conviction as to what is real and what is unreal will not worry about small things of this world. That's one advantage of taking to spiritual life. That's one advantage of even these retreats and then listening to lectures. Because retreats and lectures, reading scriptures, will at least intellectually give us the idea. There are higher things up there to worry about. So let us worry about these higher things. Thought meaning of life, relevance of life. Why should we worry about all these petty things and life is short, maybe 90 years, even in the United States, 90 years is not an easy thing. But that's the utmost we can do, more or less. So why should we worry about these small things? So Nitya, Nitya was to Veda. Nitya means the real, the eternal, anitya means the not eternal. that which is not absolutely real, that is anicca. So the first qualification itself will take us a long distance towards spiritual goal. Even the very idea there are higher things in this world to worry about, to bother about, will help us to take a very balanced approach towards small things, smaller problems. Just as grown-up people will not fight if they lose a pebble or if they lose a chocolate. Children may. So this is one interesting advantage. Once this happens, you know, then we are able to make progress.
Gampirananda's interpretation of this he also refers to, it can be interpreted as, for whom all this?
That's a really kasyasi, whose is this? That is a literal meaning. Shankaracharya also says, the Tikakara says, this also helps you to practice self-restraint while thinking of these empirical pressures. The earlier one, tektena gunjitam, tyagena gunjitam, means enjoy, but after practicing renunciation. So, how do we enjoy after practicing renunciation? This is a translation of Shankara's comment. So whose it is? Say this belongs to the world. Why? Because Isha Avasidadhyam. Isha Avasividam Sarva. This whole world, Shankaracharya is coming. It means this whole world is to be enveloped by God. That's the idea behind. So if everything belongs to God, then how can you say this is yours? So when you practice renunciation, you naturally get rid of the idea it belongs to you. So kasyasid means whose? Idam dhanam kasyasid. Whose wealth is this? It's not yours. So when you practice tyaktena means tyagena, when you practice tyaga, what happens, you know, then you won't entertain the feeling this belongs to you. That's it. So the kasyasid dhanam helps you to practice self-restraint. Tena tektena, that word helps you to practice tyaga. That is Shankara's thesis.
So we could say that the kasyasudhanam is atma-vichara, like the questioning aspect.
Kasyasudhanam means it doesn't belong to you. You practice bhoga in the empirical sense only when you think it is yours. You will be able to practice tyaga when you keep in mind, it is not yours. It belongs to God. Because why? Idam sarvam jagat isha avasitati. The entire world is to be pervaded, is to be seen as being enveloped by God. So it helps you to practice renunciation. Is it so?
The entire universe is enveloped by God. That statement, the person who is trying to start Karma Yoga is not evident. So he cannot really do Karma Yoga in its truest essence.
Yeah, he will be able to practice the idea that these things really do not belong to him, and these things are not meant for him to exploit or enjoy. At least as an idea, in the beginning, you know, vichara, you know, vastu vichara means contemplation of this higher idea. First it comes only as a concept. But the concept itself, when it becomes sincere, sraddha, then that concept takes you to higher level. So you don't start with saying that unless it is unless I experience, I won't accept it. You can't do that. Because many things, many ideas, the Shastra, the scriptures, we have to understand as ideas. And as we sincerely understand, it becomes a sincere conviction. Once the conviction comes, you know, then we will understand this world is not to be enjoyed through bhoga, but to be enjoyed through tyaga. So enjoyment through bhoga, or bhoga means enjoyment, making use of it, or tyaga, or renunciation. You can enjoy through renunciation.
I have a question. When that first sentence, that everything is enveloped by God, I've always, every time I read it, the question comes in my mind.
Yeah.
Is this a statement of fact to be realized, or is this a course of spiritual sadhana? To follow,
yes.
Which one is
it? Yeah. It is the reality, the fact, but right now you should take it as an idea, but keep in mind this idea. Because when we will be able to see the course of our day-to-day life, when we keep a higher idea in our mental horizon. So when we think everything is pervaded by the divine reality, and then this world, which is pervaded by divine reality, is not there for us to exploit, to enjoy. But rather, everything is divine. So, but then we cannot run away from this world. We are also part of it. But then how do we leave this world? Leave this world. Experience this world. But remember, it is the divine reality. And that helps us to practice renunciation. Renunciation, the next verse says, renunciation of desire for the results of object. Next verse, you know, you should live in this, you should have a desire to live in this world for 100 years. Then, na karma lippede narendra, this work will not affect you. You go on doing this work, go on living this world, doing your duty. Normally, when we do things, our actions affect us. Our action will affect us mentally and physically. But if you practice this action and renunciation, it will not affect you. That's why na karma lippede narendra. If you practice this, then you can live in this world, but still remain unaffected by this world and your actions. So in course, you know, this is the very beginning. In course, as the text unfold, you'll understand meaning becomes more and more obvious. First, the Upanishad presents before you a great grand statement, which is a fact, which is an experience for the highest spiritual seeker, for a great yogi. But it's a goal to be attained for the beginner. But the beginner should keep in his mental horizon the distant goal, because that helps him to follow the right track. That's it. The first sentence itself presents before you the highest spiritual reality, experience, which everyone should strive to attain and reach. We have 5 minutes more. Anybody from here?
Swami, does it come down to surrender? From what you're saying, it seems to me that the essence is surrender, which means releasing the ego, all of which is a preliminary to coming to this.
You know, in actually, surrender, the word Sanskrit is prapatti or saranagati. When it is explained, Acharya's teachers say, you need not worry about your ego. When you surrender, what happens is your ego gets a spiritual orientation. So, in bhakti tradition, a devotee doesn't make an analysis of his ego. What he does is, even his ego also he surrenders. So, his ego gets a spiritual orientation, a spiritual color. That's why Lord Krishna doesn't recommend surrender of ego for a beginner. For a beginner, ego should be spiritual, given a spiritual orientation. once this ego is spiritually oriented, you know what happens? Then it becomes a higher ego. That ego takes you beyond the lower ego. Sri Ramakrishna uses his own language to explain this idea of bhakti, mean devotional tradition. What happened to Girishchandra Ghosh? He did not surrender his ego. What he did, all right, I give my whole responsibility to him. But by doing that, he was actually surrendering his ego, but he did not make that statement. He did not know what he was doing. So when a devotee, when he surrenders himself to God, actually through spiritualization of his ego becomes spiritual ego. In a way, it is surrendering of his individual lower ego. The ego becomes a universal spiritual ego. Then God's will starts functioning through him. Which means his lower ego is suppressed in the spiritual, in God's grace. When he's sincere, that person really becomes free from ego. He tried to drink, he could not drink because he thought, well, I have given my promise to him. So what happens, you know? Practically, his ego is now surrendered, gone, vanished. That's the idea behind. But he doesn't make a statement, I'm surrendering my ego. No. A devotee cannot make the statement. Well, I'm surrendering everything to him. I can give the example of one Christian missionary who worked in India for many years, Stanley Jones, you know. He fell sick. He was an Anglican. He fell sick. And I mentioned this in a few Sunday lectures. He was a radical missionary who even criticized Gandhi. Gandhi is a good man, but he'll go to hell because he's not baptized, he said. Mm-hmm. But the same man finally said, there's only one Christian I have seen in my life, that's Gandhi, at the end. But there's an interesting incident between these two events. What happened? He fell sick and doctors failed to cure him. And then he, according to one version, it was Gandhi who recommended him to take prayer. Anyway, he started praying. He prayed for many months. It didn't work. And one night, he spent whole night in prayer. And in the morning, he felt so frustrated. God was not listening to him. He was praying for a few months. Well, God, I won't even pray to you. I closed my bargain here. That statement is God. I closed my bargain here. That's how he concluded. It was early morning. From that moment onwards, it is said, he started recovering. Mm. Now, what really happened here? He didn't say, I'm surrendering my ego. What he did, without making an analysis of his personality or ego, well, hold, you take whatever you want. That may apparently reckless surrender, which you find in Girishchandra Ghosh and also internationally, that takes a spiritual seeker straight to God's door when he's sincere. So that's what happened. So there, a devotee doesn't make a statement of surrendering his ego. What he does, he puts the whole burden on God's head. Now do whatever you want. But that, when it's sincere, as it happened in the case of this missionary, and also in Greece in the first days, it really worked. Yes, I did. Yes. The ego gets merged in the higher spiritual phenomenon, which is called God's grace or whatever it is. Yes. So, we conclude now. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So I shall read out the program for the afternoon. So that you can get the paper, but for information.
It's on the bulletin board office.
Still. From 10 to 10, 10 to 11:30, discussion and of course interaction. From 11:30 to 11:50, refreshments. From 11:50 to 1 o'clock, walk and meditation. From 1 to 5, free time. Evening session, from 5 to 6:15, we have prayer here, khandana, meditation. From 5 to 6:15. from 6:15 to 6:35, free time and supper preparation. From 6:35 to 8, supper and cleanup. From 8 to 9, readings from Swami Vivekananda. Then Sunday, July 31st, the last day. Morning session, 10 to 11:30, discussion, secrets of Karma Yoga. 11:30 to 12, walk and meditation. 12 noon, of course, then lunch and dinner. Thank you. So we will have refreshments now.